Hello and welcome to History of Christian Theology. My name is Chad Kim. This week I'll be talking with my dad about my book, The Way of Humility, St. Augustine's Theology of Preaching, out with Catholic University Press. And Catholic University Press has kindly supplied me with multiple copies of the book, so it is published with them, and we are going to do a giveaway for this podcast. So I don't know if you'll be hearing this in time or not, but do check out our Facebook page and our Twitter page. We're going to start doing a lot of book giveaways there, so do like us on Facebook and on Twitter. But I'm very excited. My dad read my book, asked me a few questions, and so we thought it'd be fun to release this episode where I get interviewed rather than doing the interviewing. So thank you for listening. Also, do rate us, review us on iTunes. This podcast will be early released on Patreon. All our new episodes will be released early on Patreon. And so if you're a Patreon supporter, you can get a little bit sooner. Join our community there. I've had lots of nice comments and questions. Karen Wagner has said that she really appreciates Grant Bellchamber's interviewing qualities. She liked his episode with... Drew Johnson. So anyway, do check us out on Patreon, become a follower and a supporter, helps us keep the podcast going. And you can also have some interaction with me on there. So without further ado, here is my conversation with my dad about my book on Augustine and preaching. Well, there you go. You're live.
All right. Greetings, everyone. This is Charles G. Kim Sr. On the podcast with Charles G. Kim Jr., number one, talking to number two about The Way of Humility, Chad's recently published book that he's very excited about. We in the family are all very excited about it. And I suggested to him that since he is so gracious and interviews folks that have recently written books, that it would be a nice turn to have a Charles Kim interview, about the way of humility. So we're excited to do that. Chad, how about you? You excited?
Oh, man, I'm so excited. I almost said, well, you said one and two, and then it made me think my son three is asleep. At least I hope he's asleep behind me. So they're all kind of around.
Yes, right. CGK 1, 2, and 3. Sometimes we're all in the same place, and it is a real thrill for me and an honor to be talking to Chad about his book. I am so proud of him for what he's accomplished, and our whole family is. And actually, kind of my first question about the book. Is one that you put to the family mm-hmm. when you got close, I guess, to the book being published. You got to make a choice on the cover illustration. And I remember you gave us two or three choices, and I remember a little bit of the stories, and I think you went with the family's vote about the cover illustration. So why don't you talk to us, for those that haven't seen it, explain what it is, where it came from, what's it mean, how does it relate to the book, all of those things.
Yeah, well, thank you. Also, it is, I always I'm very appreciative. Jamie, my sister, also told me that I have to be better about receiving like kind words from people, because I think I did an interview at one point and I just sort of like let someone say something very nice and I didn't respond. So let me just say it is very humbling and very I'm very fortunate. I realize that as the older I get, how fortunate I am that my parents tell me that they're proud of me. So I know that that's a great gift. And not everyone can say the same. And so I just want to be grateful for what I have been given, and hope that I can return that favor as well to my kids. And also say, I mean, I'm proud of my parents, but also but proud of my kids. Right. Well, so And if it wasn't clear, people probably don't know that much about me. I've actually been getting some questions from people about my sort of faith background and different things. But I'm very close to my family. So I just mentioned my sister, my kids, my dad. We haven't heard about my brother and my mom and my wife and but all we're really intertwined here. So.
Although we do show up in the introduction, so for all those that'll read, you get to hear a little bit about parental influence, and then Chad writes a very beautiful paragraph about the way Abby, his wife, has supported him in writing the book. So again, those are all things that are especially cool to you if you're a family member. But go ahead, tell us about that cover and the
right. So yeah, I've never actually used my recordings, as I was talking to my dad about earlier, but you can see the book if this ever goes out anywhere. But I'll post a picture maybe with the episode or something. So this picture is actually from North Africa. It's from the Museum Hall of Roman Mosaics in Tunisia, the Bardo National Museum. We don't know who made it, but it's presumably a 5th century mosaic of two people fishing. And they sort of look like they could be like the disciples or something. Just two people casting their nets in a small boat. We probably came from a floor of a wealthy Roman villa or somewhere. But I chose the picture because the original title of the dissertation was actually called something like From Orator to Piscator, St. Augustine's Preaching the Humble Word and the Sermones ad Populum. It's my current title is not particularly short, but the original dissertation title was especially cumbersome. But that From Orator to Piscator, those are two Latin words that Augustine likes because they rhyme. And so there's a way that he uses this kind of rhetorical device. And we know that actually the wordplay that he would use as he spoke was a kind of mnemonic device almost. It was something that when people were listening, they could, they would like, oh yeah, on Sunday we heard orator piscator. And actually at another point, he talks about peccator, a word for sinner. And essentially it's Christ through grace that transforms a piscator into an orator who was once also a pescator or a peccator, a sinner. And all of these words sort of rhyme. I think there's something like 20 or 25 places that he uses this rhyming scheme within the sermons. I always just liked the wordplay. I liked the contrast. And it was not something that anyone had commented on in any of the literature on Augustine's sermons and Augustine generally, this particular kind of leitmotif, I call it in the book. So that was why I chose it. I think it is especially fitting. But the other option was a picture from the St. Louis Art Museum, and it was a lesser-known Renaissance picture of Augustine being baptized by Ambrose. And I liked that one because it connected with my home, with St. Louis, where I was raised, and at an art museum that I've been to, not a ton of times, but it'd been to a fair number of times, had seen the picture live. I'd actually taken Charlie to see it one time when I was finishing the dissertation, and I saw it when we were looking for something to do some afternoon, and I was like, oh, that'd be cool. Tie my book jacket into where I'm from. But it was not a... the other quick thing to say is every single Augustine book has the same cover art, it seems like. And it's a picture of Augustine holding his heart in his hand with a light coming down from what looks like the sun. And it says Veritas in it, the truth. And it's like Augustine loves the imagery of a heart set on fire for God. If you've ever heard that phrase, it at least goes back as far as Augustine. I don't know if it I don't actually know the origins of the phrase, but Augustine loves to talk about a heart on fire for God. So most people use that picture. I was trying to find something different. And so that's kind of some of the backstory.
Sure. So give us the tie of the fisherman kind of to the overall theme of the book.
Yeah. Right. So the overall theme of the book is like, you know, as Augustine, it's an image that he takes from the Gospels. So he preaches. So my dissertation was focused on a collection of his sermons called the Sermons to the People. This is an unedited collection. He has three connections. No, four collections of sermons. One's on the Psalms. One's on John's the Johannine literature, and then one on the Sermon on the Mount. But anyway, he's got a few of these collections of sermons. And so I was trying to focus on this other one that he never edited. And he uses this phrase, like I say, a number of times, but one of the key themes in all of Augustine's writing is the role of pride and humility. And so the fisherman for Augustine is a kind of example of humility. So a fisherman was a very low status position in Roman culture and Roman society. I think I mentioned this a little bit in the book in the section. Maybe in chapter 4, I also have an article that I wrote on this as well. But so it seems that that fishermen were, I don't know why exactly, but it was like even for sport, it was considered like unmanly because you didn't actually kill the fish. You just sort of trapped it. And they thought that like other kinds of hunting were more valiant. Fishermen just really were just the lowest of the low. So Augustine thinks that it's particularly powerful that the people that he chooses, half the disciples or so, right? Or maybe not quite half, are fishermen. And he doesn't choose the person who Christ explicitly doesn't select to tell his story of his arrival and who he is. The people that he doesn't select are the people that would have like a person like Augustine. Augustine is an orator. Augustine was chosen by the emperor to be his herald. So Augustine knows all of the high speech. And it's one of the things that's so puzzling to him about the Bible so I try to go through the backstory of his kind of education. Augustine had been told his whole life, you are super well educated. You are a good speaker. All the best people want to listen to you. You're it. Like, you're the coolest person on the block because of your ability to speak. And so then he like reads the Bible and he kind of goes, well, wait a minute. God comes to earth and doesn't do what our emperors do, doesn't do what society has told me to do. Like, this doesn't even make any sense. At first he rejects it, right? At first he says, I don't want to have anything to do with the Bible. So he uses that play on the fisherman and the orator because he realizes himself, like, he has to be humble enough to listen to a fisherman tell him about who God is. That's just too much for him for a while.
Right, right. I also, there are a number of places in the book where you talk about the kind of people that Augustine talked to or that he pastored and preached to. And there was a full range. You had sort of the rural, sort of less educated people. And as an orator, he was used to sort of high levels of speech, high speech, complex thoughts. And he had to bring that message down to where the humble fisherman could understand it. And that was just as important to get the message there as it was to the his potentially sophisticated listeners and probably the people earlier in his life that he spent all of his time arguing before when he was sort of in his rhetorical phase or his phase in order. So maybe to change off of that, we'll probably come back. But you talked a little bit about some of the other books and the covers, and one of the things you taught me about a dissertation that I did not know, that a dissertation needed to be have new research. It needed to focus on an area that had not been covered before. So what, I mean, there's lots of books about Augustine covering all different kinds of things. And you quote a lot of them and you go through with the laboriously, like I think you're supposed to go through and explain, here's what others have said. And then you come through with what's different. Talk to us a little bit about what makes yours different. What makes this research something new?
Yeah. Well, it's one of the most daunting questions, or at least it always had been for me. I had been introduced to this idea maybe late in college or maybe in my master's program. I don't remember. I didn't always know that I wanted to do a PhD per se. But when someone said that I had to have an original idea, I was raised reading the same Bible as you and everyone else. You know, Ecclesiastes says there's nothing new under the sun. And so, you know, there's a little bit of hubris, a little bit of pride to say, I'm going to say something that no one else has said something about, or I'm going to have an idea that no one else has ever had. So that's always been a little daunting to me. But that's why a lot of people choose obscure topics, right? So at this point in human history, I remember one friend of mine was telling me about he was originally thinking about researching something about Russian Orthodoxy in Alaska because people had come across the land bridge that was once there to like minister. So there was like, you know, Russian Orthodox. And there's like one or two examples of this, and it's like super obscure. And I was like, I mean, that's fascinating that that even exists, but there can't be very much there. But, but the person who was telling me this was like, well, part of the difficulty of the dissertation is you have to comment on something or you have to have an idea, research something that has never been talked about. Or if it has been talked about, you have to present it in a new light. So I dug deep on these sermons that fewer people had done a lot of research on. So some of the originality is just the particular emphasis. That is, these sermons, this uncollected, unwieldy kind of large collection of things. But the most original part of it, and this is one of your questions. I looked at some of the questions beforehand, but speech act theory had never been applied to Augustine before. And so that's, kind of a new lens in reading Augustine, is thinking about this idea of speech act theory. Maybe the thing that I was proudest of, even beyond speech act theory, was just tracing how Augustine tried to live out what he thought that he believed. He talked about humility and he talked about pride being the chief sin. And I just thought, well, that's interesting. How do you preach about humility? Because how do you have an example for that? And, a lot of times preachers, myself, I mean, I've preached some, it's really easy to talk about yourself, but you don't want to make yourself the example of humility. So what are you going to do? How are you going to show this? That's really where I felt like I had something unique to offer. Augustine has a kind of, an acolyte, a friend, a student, someone that had stood by him for many years, a guy called Pisidius. And Pisidius wrote his own biography of Augustine after Augustine dies. Pisidius helps Augustine organize all the things that he's written in his library at Hippo right before he dies. And Pisidius says about Augustine, he says, he's the kind of person who would speak this way and also act this way. So he says, like, and he says, the thing is, you could read what Augustine wrote, and you could read the sermons that he gave, but there's, you know, there was nothing like actually hearing him deliver it and actually seeing him live it out. And I was like, okay, well, that's some cool praise. And how would I ever crack that nut? How could we ever know? Well, the sermons, these particular sermons, were recorded by a notarius, what we call them in Latin, but it's a note taker, and they were never edited. So they're kind of a bare record of how Augustine spoke to people. And I said, well, it'd be interesting if we could actually uncover how he spoke to people who probably weren't from the same social class as him, and if it showed his humility, and if actually that comes through, and to sort of prove if Posidius was right. And so, I mean, of course, the hard part is, I mean, I'm an Augustine acolyte. I love Augustine. So I want him to be right. Like, I'll just be honest. Like, I'm not an objective scientist in a way that I probably should be. But I wanted him to be right. But I also think there's evidence that he was. Like, I think that that's what the sermons show. I think that the fact that he, you know, had this long career, and that he stayed in Hippo, and that, you know, the things that he did, I think, show that he meant it when he said it.
Right. And, it, you know, it's clear as you look at Augustine's life that he did, you know, he had the best education. He grew up with status as a Roman citizen, and was educated in the most influential and sought after places. And to position himself as the Bishop of Hippo, if I've got the terminology right there, yep, he took a step down, and then to bring the gospel message to, you know, the rural types that he spoke to, that in itself is an example of his humility, of his humbleness. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that he took those steps. So I think that argues in favor. It was interesting to me to think about this concept of understanding, to know that he lived humbly, as opposed to he spoke about humility. And somewhere in the speech act theory is kind of where, you know, this is where it kind of got above my head. And if you would maybe just clarify, speech act theory includes the components of locution, illocution, and perlocution. And I know that was, that was a central theme and was in there, but just draw that out for a layman like myself.
Yeah.
Help me there.
Yeah. Well, so, and I, you know, we talked a little beforehand, but, so the speech act theory is an interesting part in the dissertation process. So one of the things that happens is you write a dissertation, you can defend a dissertation, but it's not always published as a book. And so mine was, so I had to go through an academic review process. So two people who I don't know, they were blind reviewers. One of them said, just take the speech act theory out of your book and it'll be better. One of them said, I think it's helpful, but maybe, you know, he was like, but you don't necessarily need it. And there was sort of a little bit of ambivalence in one. One reviewer just said, take it out altogether. And then my editor said, it's up to you. And I was like, well, I like speech act theory in there. I think trying to tie it into this idea can be helpful. So what is it? Well, So speech act theory is a philosophy that was developed in the 20th century by a guy called J.L. Austin. And so he was a philosopher who basically asked the question, I mean, I think his first book is called How to Do Things with Words. And so it was kind of the idea that the thing that he thought was interesting philosophically was language doesn't just encode truth propositions. That would be how certain kind of philosophers would talk. Like, language is about how do we communicate what's true, or how do we communicate things, and how does it, you know, and that kind of just stating a bare fact. But Austin said, well, sometimes words do things in the world. And it's not really about their truth or falseness per se. There's other things. And so Austin analyzed different things. Like, for instance, when a pastor says, I now pronounce you man and wife, there's something about that phrase where he's not saying – he is saying something that becomes true, but something that wasn't true when he originally thought it. So but the phrase, the locution – would be the phrase, I now pronounce you man and wife. The illocution is something like how he says it based on his authority, based on his stature. And the paralocution would be about how it's received. Does the community hearing this proclamation, this illocution, does it have the effect that its intended effect? And so does the community recognize the authority? So you can think about the phrase, I now pronounce you man and wife. If my daughter's playing with her stuffed animals and she enacts a wedding and says, I now pronounce, Mickey and Minnie, husband and wife. Well, it's cute and it's funny, but we laugh because she doesn't have the authority to do that. And so there's something about the paralocution that doesn't work. She has the locution, she has the phrase, she says it as if she has the authority to say it, but the people listening, my wife, myself, my son, you know, Charlie probably wouldn't chuckle, but my wife and I would chuckle, because we know that it doesn't work. Because we're talking a little bit about me. My favorite example of this is in The Office. Michael Scott, in the middle of his – like, he realizes – I can't remember, season 3 or 4, something like that. He's lost a whole bunch of money. Jan takes all of his money. And at one point, he stands up in the middle of the office and he says, I declare bankruptcy. Oh, shoot. I lost you. Did you hear me?
You need to go back. At some point, he stands up. That's when you froze.
Yeah. So at some point, he stands up in the middle of the office and he says, I declare bankruptcy. And everyone laughs. Why do we all laugh? Because we know that that's not how this works. But he declares it as if he has the authority and the people will hear him. And suddenly that declaration, that locution, makes him bankrupt. So Austin thought this kind of thing was really funny. So, you know, does Augustine know speech act theory? No. But Augustine knows that his words do something. Now I'm realizing you're so his words do something, right? So Augustine says
you froze for just a second there.
Yeah. So Augustine uses a phrase in De Doctrina Christiana, this book that he wrote for preachers. It's called On Christian Teaching. It's basically a preaching manual. That's how it's used in the medieval period, especially the fourth book. And he says at the end, he says that the preacher should act as far as he is able so that he is heard obediently, intelligently, obediently, and happily, or something like that. But the point being that it's up to the preacher to act in his speech so that he is understood. And so I say that basically Augustine understands the principle of speech act theory, even if he doesn't know J.L. Austin, obviously. And so he knows that there's something powerful about what the preacher does. But then if he wants to be understood, If he wants to be understood, he has to speak at a level that people will understand. So there's another part of that. Like he says, a preacher is at pains to make sure that he is understood well. Well, how is he going to be understood if the whole point of his education was to prove how smart he was with his ability to turn a phrase? And we think that 85% at least of his audience was probably illiterate. They're not going to have the background that he does. And so it just, you know, if you speak all the time, you know, at the highest register possible with the biggest words that you can come up with, you're going to limit the amount of people that you could speak to. I mean, you know, this is, they talk about the dumbing down of presidential addresses and stuff, like, you know, at what grade level are they spoken to? And it's an, you know, ever decreasing grade level. But to some extent, why does a president do that? Well, because they want to be understood by the broadest possible audience. I've gone on really long, but this is, yeah.
No, that's really good. And actually, the way you the illustrations around the wedding, that kind of you know, pronouncing man and wife, and even the joke from The Office.
I couldn't put that in the dissertation. I couldn't put that in the book. I should have, yeah. But
well, it did come through, and it is you know, I think certainly Augustine. You know, he had the capacity, he had the authority to deliver the word. And, you know, I would say, you know, one of my takeaways from the book is around the perlocution, which is, you know, what do people do with it? And you talked near the end of the book a lot about, you know, Augustine kind of soliciting comment or asking questions and looking for an amen, I guess, from time mm-hmm. to time, sort of the response that, which I think fits into that perlocution.
Yep. That's right.
And then also within that same section, towards the end of the book, I guess it's the soteriology, Augustine's soteriology. You talked about how he expected his audience to participate by praying during mm-hmm. the sermon, mm-hmm. which, you know, I think and about why that was important. And what came to me was we have a responsibility as listeners in a sermon. Mm-hmm. You go to church to be entertained a lot of times and, you know, to be spoon-fed some lesson, and you expect it to be entertaining, make you laugh a little bit, hold your attention, not bore you. And, you know, this just sort of turned that on its head. And after I read that section, the next time I went to church, I said, all right, my job here, I need to pray. To look for what God has for me in this sermon, regardless of the speaker and his eloquence, you know, as long as he's using the word and reading the scripture and putting it out there, God has something for me, and I can be changed and I can interact with that. I thought that was a very powerful and practical way, and it's kind of humbling again, because we come we come thinking, all right, you need to do a great job in your sermon, you need to wow me, you need to entertain me, and you know, no, it's not that at all. it's our job to interact, it's our job to pray, to receive what God has for us. So I talk a lot there, so why don't you know sort of move around within some of that thought.
Well, yeah, that's helpful. And you know, one of the next kind of the next steps, you know, one of the things they ask you in in the conclusion is like, what are some things that you want to do with the book and the research later? Like, what are further directions you can take? And one of them is just sort of that I want to take is like, how can I sort of summarize some of these great things that I've sort of found, even sort of more practical things that I've found from my study. And that, you know, that's one of the things that my sister Jamie likes to tell me to think about. But also, you know, in terms of like receiving this sermon, I think that, you know, it's interesting. So Augustine calls it an exercitatio animi in Latin, and we get the word exercise from it. And he says that actually the sermon is kind of an exercise for you. It's just an exercise for your soul. And he says, so, you know, when you come into a sermon, he expects you to get some mental some spiritual exercise, you know, some mental, but some spiritual. Like, he wants you to follow along. He wants you to ask questions in your own mind as you're going through this. And actually sometimes maybe even out loud, you know, he kind of wants people to indicate, like, are they following him? And you know, he gives a sermon on the Trinity, is one of the examples that I give. You know, Trinity, one of the most difficult things to talk about in Christian theology. And Augustine expects, like, he says out loud, to his people, he says, I can tell some of you are indicating to me that you're following, but I can also tell that some of you are indicating that you're not following. And he's like, and you know what? If you get it, that's great, but I got to make sure that everyone is on board. And so these are the actual words, right? So as a speaker, he is intimately aware of what he thinks, how the listener is responding to him. And so in a sense, sometimes a sermon feels like a one-way kind of thing. It's the preacher standing up, broadcasting his words to the people, and they are just passive receptors. And for Augustine, for Augustine, they're not passive receptors, right? They're supposed to be active participants. And so that is, you know, that's pretty amazing in some ways, because that's not how a lot of, I mean, well, you know, sort of maybe a upper class sort of Western audience, maybe we're less likely to make a lot of noise in a sermon or whatever. But Augustine wanted that, or at least some kind of give and take. But here's what he wanted even more than that. So why is it an exercise in the soul? It's not just to understand, but, you know, if the audience is, as I say, 85% people who maybe didn't have the ability to read, this is the only time that they're going to engage in the word. So if you know, you think about the time that they get on Sunday, that's the only time that they get to hear the scriptures. And so what they're taking from the scriptures is of critical importance for their life of faith. So they need to be on the ball when they're there listening to him preach, because they don't have, you know, it's going to be another 1,200 years after Augustine's preaching before the printing press, and then even several hundred years after that before there'll be Bibles in every home. And so you have to do your spiritual work in the sermon on Sunday. And the very final piece, the parallocution, I tie to to grace. And that's why we talk about soteriology. And so Augustine is also aware that he can do all the song and dance he wants. The people can do their best. But he says it's up to God to give the increase. And he quotes St. Paul from 1 Corinthians. And he says it's God who gives the increase. The rusticus is the word that he uses in Latin, which means country bumpkin, the rube. It's the country bumpkin who's out working the field, and the rain waters, but it's God who actually produces the increase. Deus incrementum dat is the Latin. And he says, so all of this, the actual parallocution, though, for the Christian, the final parallocution is about God being at work. And that is something that nobody can control. You can do all the things, but you're ultimately left in some final sense dependent on God to make the words make sense to you and your soul.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, a couple of ideas that came out to me, you know, the preacher can only do so much. And the preacher has a great responsibility. And the way you talked about the fact that they didn't have the written word that they could read, or if they did have it, they couldn't have read it anyway. Certainly, you know, preaching is a method of communication that God endorses, and it's got a special endorsement, and we should treat it as such. And you know, we as listeners and the preachers, but no matter how entertaining or how adept the preacher is at expressing his ideas, it's God that makes the difference. And you know, we can be there to receive it, and it's, and you know, I part of what we pray about is for the Holy Spirit to reveal to us in the Word that the pastor is bringing forth, reveal to us what God, how God wants to engage with us, and what God wants us to take away. And it really does. It does sort of raise the level of importance of a sermon, and also it raises the bar on a pastor. And I mean, it makes me feel for them a little bit, because they have a significant responsibility every time they get up. And sometimes some of them say it, and you know, you just sort of want to say, that they're this is just pastorally speaking, so to speak. But in fact, I think it's real. I think that's a real responsibility, and it's an awesome one for them.
Yeah.
Let's see. I've got lots of questions. There's one concept in the final chapter that you used, and I just thought it was interesting. It was this deified eyes.
Uh-huh.
The concept of deified eyes. So I think it kind of relates to what we've just been talking about. So explain that concept.
Yeah. So Augustine only uses this phrase once in the sermons, but it's a sort of tantalizing phrase. And so one way to think about it is in his Christology, that is his understanding of Christ. He says that some people who saw Jesus of Nazareth walking in Palestine, in Israel, they might have seen him as a human. But we can think of Peter, right? Peter, when Jesus asks Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" And he says, you are the Christos, you are the anointed one, you are the Messiah of God. So at that point, it's sort of like Augustine saying he has deified eyes. That is, he has eyes with the capability of seeing who Christ really is, and actually seeing God in Jesus. But that is not something that's made available to everyone all the time, right? So like Peter has this this moment, and then he goes on to deny him, and you know, all these other things. But there's, you know, not everyone has this. Not everyone sees Jesus for who he is. Pilate mocks him and washes his hands of him, maybe doesn't mock him, but washes his hands of him. The soldiers mock him, you know, and he's called a blasphemer, these sorts of things. But that's the deified eye. So I like the phrase deified eyes from Augustine, because the other thing that he thinks that can happen is he thinks that sort of spiritually we can be given a vision of God. And so our eyes, in a way, they have to become like God in order for us to see God for who God is. The other kind of tantalizing sort of theology behind it that is less at home in typical Protestant circles and maybe Western circles generally is this idea of deification. And so in Eastern Orthodoxy, usually, that's usually how it's portrayed, there's this idea that, you know, Saint Athanasius says Christ became the Son of God became man so that man might become God. And you might hear that, and a lot of Westerners, and I, you know, first time I hear that, well, you mean like God? Like, do you really mean becomes God? And you know, and of course, Athanasius seemed to mean what he said. You know, I think we can think about it. We could actually put the emphasis on the word become there, and say God doesn't become anything. There is no becoming in God, right? Because God eternally is who God is. And so actually, in a sense, it's actually the becoming, which is the you know, most unique word in that phrase. But Augustine actually, so I studied under a guy called David McConey, and Father McConey made his dissertation was on Augustine and deification. And so this is actually, you know, this is a little bit of an homage to him and his work on saying that actually Augustine has a similar theology of deification at work. And so he, you know, so Augustine seems to think that, you know, ultimately what salvation is becoming like God in order to see God for who God is. And you know, some people will, I know that there will be listeners who are listening to this and who will want me to say more, and I should just say we will become God. And even I'm still a little, you know, I don't know. It's still a little like, I'd want to tease that out and think about it more. I do have episodes where we talk about deification. I have some good episodes with Mike Hobbits from he's from New Zealand on deification. But that's a nod to that. And I do think that that is part of Augustine's theology. And so that's in the sermon, though. We're given these words, the words of Scripture, which Augustine thinks those are the special – there's something sacramental in the words. And so what does that mean? What is a sacrament? Well, Augustine says that a sacrament is a special kind of sign. It's a sign that gives you the thing that it's a sign of. And so we can think of smoke is a sign of fire, right? It's not fire, but it's a sign that there is fire. But Augustine says that a sacrament is sort of like a sign, but that actually has the thing in it. And so if you think of like, it's like smoke that actually also has fire. And so the Scriptures are a very special kind of word. They're not just a word that reminds you about who God is, but they kind of give you God. There's a sense in which we are given the presence of God in a unique way in these very words. And so these words can help us see who God is in a way that no other words can.
Say that last part again. These words, what?
Yeah, so the very words of Scripture, because they're words spoken by the Word, are words that can show us who God is in a way that no other words can. They are a sacrament in a way. They are in some special way giving us the thing that they signify.
Yeah, and you know, I think that idea of, you know, the sermon and the Scripture allowing us to see God who he is, see Jesus for who he is, see God for who he is, that kind of gives us those deified eyes, our ability to see and connect with that. And then, you know, the becoming God is an odd concept, but if you think about it, you know, in our Christian journey, we talk about being more and more Christ-like, more mm-hmm. and more like God. Yeah. And that's not a foreign concept at all. Right. So I think that journey, that desire to live and to act and to be who God wants us to be is in effect, you know, it's certainly becoming Christ-like, maybe becoming Christ, not so much, but becoming God. I think it can work that way.
Yeah.
So let's back up just a little bit. And I don't think I ever asked you this, but part of the dissertation process, I know their job, I think, is to push back on you a little bit when you actually do your dissertation. Are there mm-hmm. what parts of the book did you, and maybe they just asked the questions to poke and to prod you and have you prove how you were thinking and prove your points. But were there anything, I mean, the speech act theory, obviously your editors gave you a little bit of feedback about including that. Anything else that was kind of controversial that you had to stand up for as you presented these concepts in your dissertation?
Well, so Carol Harrison was on my committee. So in the Oxford system, you have an outside reviewer of any dissertation, and it's their job to be the devil's advocate. So Carol Harrison was kind of my outside reviewer, and she was like, "Well, it's kind of my job to give you a hard time," and at least in my system. So she was gracious, but she did give me a little bit of a hard time. And one of the things that she gave me a hard time about, rightfully so, was that I didn't spend enough time on the power of grace, in the transformation. So actually the whole section on deified eyes, some of like that whole final chapter was rewritten after my defense. Half, three quarters of it are basically a new dissertation. Father McConey, he had me basically have some theological connection with every chapter. So every chapter is called like Augustine's. So it's the theology of preaching, theology of language, theology of culture, theology of evangelism, Christology, ecclesiology, soteriology. That is basically McConey's advice to me after I defended. He said, "This will make a better book." I changed some stuff at the beginning for that, but the framing it in that way was his advice. Those are both, those were both things that like to go from dissertation to book, I spent, I don't know, 6 months or something editing, changing, that sort of thing.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. I don't think I realized that. But I guess that's what the process is supposed to be. That sort of debate, strengthens your thoughts and causes you to make some changes. I was sort of going back and reviewing some of my notes, and I know this is jumping around, but I thought this was kind of a fun concept. You talk about Augustine's letter defining Christian truth to the young student, Diochorus. And
Diochorus,
I thought that we haven't talked a ton about humility, but that concept and the importance of that concept within Christian thought, comes across there. Why don't you tell that story?
Yeah, so I use that as my hinge, moving from rhetoric to preaching, kind of. And the reason I use it as the hinge is Demosthenes is the guy that he quotes in that letter. Demosthenes is the most famous Greek rhetorician. If Cicero is kind of the most famous Latin rhetorician, Demosthenes is the most famous Greek rhetorician. And Demosthenes says that all rhetoric can be boiled down to delivery, delivery, delivery. And so Augustine's telling this guy Dioscorus, who's going to go learn in Athens. He says, "Well, we both know, we both know Demosthenes." But he says, "But what I want you to not forget is that you're going to go study and you're going to go learn all these things, and you'll have a temptation to pride, essentially, just like I did." And he said, "But the Christian religion comes down to this: humility, humility, humility." And so it's a way of framing the Christian faith. It's a way of showing the connection for Augustine between rhetoric, which he thinks makes one proud, and Christianity, which makes one humble. And so he uses that as kind of as a framing device for Dioscorus. And I also like it because I think so it's letter what, 119, 117, it's 118. and I like it because one of the most interesting things about Augustine is we have so many of his words, but not only do we have so many of his words, we have his own telling of his own life. And then we have his words from over 50 years of his life. And so you can see him change, right? Like, you know, he's not the same person that he was. And so what would he say to a younger version of himself? Well, this is what he says to the younger version of himself. And he says, it's like he's saying, if I had only known when I started going through the rhetorical process, if I had only known that Christianity was about humility and humility and humility, it could have saved me so much heartache and so much trouble. So that's sort of how I feel like that letter, that's kind of the power of that letter to me.
Yeah, and as you think of the sort of application of your study here, humility is sometimes lost. It takes some ego, and ego tends to have pride. It takes some ego to get up in front of a bunch of people and talk to them. And so it's kind of of course that's a preacher's job. A timid person certainly, and timid isn't humble, but sometimes we equate them, is not likely to do that. It's usually somebody with some ego, with some confidence, and those are a couple of concepts kind of at war with each other, is that you need this ego to get up there and deliver this way in front of a large group of people, but you've got to be humble. Yeah. And I think a lot of times people lose that because, there's the having people's attention on you. And Augustine, as you outline it in the book, Augustine is continuously trying to fight the idea of the focus being on him and to put the focus on Christ. And that's the challenge of the preacher, is to take that focus that is so easy and is sort of alluring to want that focus, and to take that and turn it back to Christ is a huge challenge, especially for him, because early in his life, or in the earlier parts of his life, it was all about ego and talking at a level above people, so for him to change this way and become humble is just a huge deal, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things, this is somewhat contested, but I don't know that it should be. Humility wasn't an ancient virtue. Right. Even Thomas Aquinas is not 100% convinced that humility is a virtue. I think he calls it a propaedeutic for virtue. But regardless, there were people who, for most of the people that Augustine was reading, humility literally means being from the dirt. You're just a little dirt person. So we get the word humus. If a soil has humus, that's from the Latin word for dirt. So humility is a dirt, and that's, so calling God dirt is an insult. But you could also play on that too, right? So what are we but dust? It's sort of like Christ had to become the dust that we are, the dirt that we are. And that's part of the humility. The last thing I would say though, just on some of that is, one of the things, one of the interesting things about this last thing that Augustine says in De Doctrina Christiana is one of his very final admonitions to the preacher is the Latin phrase is copia a copia dicendi est forma vivendi. A bunch of words, the most copious amount of words that you can offer to someone is how you live your life. The most words that you can say are what you do. And so there's a sense in which the whole, you know, Augustine's like talks all about how one should preach, but he's like, you can throw that all away if you don't actually do it. It just becomes meaningless. If you aren't actually living this out, and you will lose, whatever kind of, power your words had, if you don't live him out. And I just think of the end of the, there's this famous podcast, the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. And they talk about how Mark Driscoll, by the end of his career at the church, you know, basically nobody knew what he was like. He was only he was a talking head on a screen, but no one knew about his character. And he had good character early on, but it seems like by the end of his career there, his character had gone out the window. And so I, you know, to me, one of the takeaways from that podcast was, you know, a preacher needs to be around the people that he's serving so they can actually see him live out the things that he says that he's proclaiming. And, you know, it doesn't change the truth of who Jesus is. It doesn't change the truth of what Christ has done for us on the cross. It doesn't change that. But your ability to really connect with people is going to be won or lost by how you live.
Yeah, and it gets increasingly difficult the larger a church you have, I think, because your ability for people to see how you live is pretty limited. In really large church settings. So let me ask you this. We're kind of getting to the end of an hour here. Is there a central thing? What, you know, it's sometimes said that, you know, you write a paper, you give a speech, you talk, you learn more yourself than your audience learns.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Can you be in a concise sort of way? What'd you learn from this particular? What would be the central theme that's your takeaway from your work in this book? And we probably have already hit on it.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of different things that I've said. I mean, it'd be hard to sum it up. I was trying to crystallize it down or something to the one thing. I think the thing that still speaks to me, that speaks to me in everything that I read from Augustine, is that he's himself. I think that Augustine does such a fabulous job of showing us who he is, and that can redound to the power of Christ as well, insofar as even when Augustine fails, he says, "I'm failing because I'm trying to live up to perfection, and I want you to see perfection." So Augustine has this way of trying to redirect everything back to Christ, right? Like that's his great goal in all of this is that, you know, in a way he would have preferred if he wasn't remembered. I don't think he did this because he wanted to be remembered. I think he did this because he wanted Christ to be known. And so I think that, you know, he tried to live and speak in a way that would imitate Christ's humility. And so he wanted to imitate Christ's humility because he wanted all of us to imitate Christ's humility. And that's, you know, that's one of the things I think I quote that at the very beginning of the book. But, so be imitators of Christ as I imitate Christ. And that's kind of, you know, that's St. Paul, but Augustine quotes that. And so I think, you know, I think that could be a kind of distillation.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent.
So I did say, all right, before we go, was it weird? You know, like I, growing up, Dad used to read all my papers at school and would mark them up and would, you know, Dad preferred an economy of language. I'm not so sure that I maybe lived up to that ideal, but, you know, you wanted shorter, punchier sentences. You wanted, you know, not so many conjunctions. You wanted, I don't know. And also, like, you wanted me to be a better writer. And so I know we spent a lot of time trying to get my papers better. I remember in ninth grade I think I got a C on a paper. I had the wrong date and, you know, this and that. And so, like, you know, I've been told, I'm not asking you to say something nice about my writing per se, but I'm just saying, like, I'm not trying to, like, milk a compliment out of here or something, but it just was sort of, I don't know, it's got to be kind of funny. You know, you didn't get an editor's pin on this one, so.
No, absolutely, I didn't. It was very humbling, I would say, you know, because as a parent, you live your life knowing more than your kids do until they get to a certain age, really. And, you know, one of the things, you know, as I think about what I have learned in life, and sometimes I use this at work when I talk to people, I've learned more from my children than I probably learned from anything. And whether that is appreciation for art, understanding digital media, or you know, understanding sports and music, following things that maybe I didn't really like all that much, but I followed those things because my kids followed them. And I, you know, as a parent, you desperately want to connect with them. I learned ice hockey from Chad because of Chad. He had the interest in ice hockey, and I didn't. You know, I could ice skate, but never played hockey a day in my life. But I ended up coaching hockey, and you know, for 10 years, helped run the hockey club at the kids' high school. And, you know, did all of that for my kids. And so, reading this, sort of the interesting thing is, most of the things I've read of yours, I understood well enough that I could decide whether you had anything wrong or not. This, it was humbling in that I couldn't really tell sometimes whether you were using the word correctly or not. But it was pretty clean. I don't know whether that's because your wife's an English major and an editor, or you had lots of editors looking at it, but there wasn't anything that I desperately wanted to correct as I went through.
And yeah. I think it was read by like 20 people by the time it went to press. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So I didn't find any mistakes, but wasn't looking. I was reading to understand. And an academic book, those of you out there that have never read an academic book, and maybe most of the people that listen to your podcast do that, it can be trying. But in the end, I got a lot out of it, a lot of application and, you know, a great appreciation for Augustine. And you know, I know, you know, as I think about why you chose this, it's because you like Augustine. I think the philosopher theologian thing, I believe that's part of his appeal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because those are things you're passionate about. And you know, it's very, again, as a parent who believes that, you know, one's relationship to God is the most important thing, the pursuit of that. You know, there's a tremendous amount of pride, not necessarily the greatest word to use, but it makes me very happy and content and satisfied to see, you know, where you are, what your focus is on. And even, you know, some would say academics can sometimes get lost and get dry, and you know, you can You know, you can slug it out with the best of the theoreticians, let's say it, but there's life in the book. There's purpose, there's feeling, there's a passion. And I think, you know, that's even, you know, again, it's caught up in and has lots of the underpinnings of an academic work that is required for a dissertation. But you can see in that the passion, and that's what I'm most proud of. I think is your passion there.
Well, thank you. That's what usually what my students say in my my reviews of my classes. I'm not always sure what Dr. Kim was talking about, but he really seemed to want us to like it. Like, and he really liked it, which is cool, but I got some passion. Right. I don't know what else I've got, but I've got that.
Yeah, well, that's it. No, you got plenty. You got plenty. Well, this was a great deal of fun. Chad and I don't often spend an hour and or hour and 10 minutes here just chatting about something, but this was a lot of fun for us. I hope all of you all listening enjoy it. And if Chad writes another book, maybe he'll invite me back on his podcast.
Got a Latin book to do to the publisher in May. So, but I don't, that one won't be fun.
No, I don't think so. I don't think I'll do that one.